there, this is Cross.
I'm PJ.
And we are Words and Whiskey, a podcast for veteran and novice readers alike. We tackle fiction novels and love to talk about what we're drinking. You should think of us as your intoxicating weekly book club.
Cross.
What?
Guess what we get to do right now.
What do you mean? What do we get to do right now?
Not just a digital cheers.
Is that a clink?
That's a physical clink.
Here, wait. Let's make sure a microphone got it. I'll just... Yep. Okay.
Yeah, all right. Click. By your microphone.
Clink. Okay. Neat.
Crossland's in town. Crossland's at my home. He's sitting in my office. He's wedged his way onto my desk.
I am kind of like I'm like a nothing person at the end of your desk here. I'm squatting at the end of your desk.
He learned how fucking frustrating my slanted floors are.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, I had a conference call and I kept sliding away from the call and I was like, what is happening? Oh, no.
It's an old house. The floors aren't technically level.
Yeah, but like, okay, PJ, there have been a couple of times where we've gotten close to dozing off when we've been recording other shows. How do you not just slide backwards? Like,
I used to.
Yeah.
I've just gotten used to like sitting. Like, I know how to sit. I know where the chair like situates itself properly. Mm-hmm. So it like in a little divot or something and it doesn't move. I don't know. I've just gotten used to it.
That is so weird.
Yep.
I mean, good for you, but yeah. How odd. Cool. All right. Well, we're here in person again, and we just cheers. So actually, maybe now we should drink. Cheers. We poured an ounce each of Hibiki Suntory whiskey. It's too good to shoot, so we're not shooting it. We're just going to sip on that in addition to everything else that we've got going on. But today is our second episode talking about The Last Argument of Kings by Joe Abercrombie. As PJ didn't mention at the top of the episode, but you can probably read with your eyes in the, you know, text thingy. Just to confirm, we're reading So Much in Common through Flowers and Plaudits. With that, PJ, go with that quick overview.
Okay.
Hit it, Captain.
Glockta threatens Jazal. Uno reverses a plot to kill him and feed him to pigs, and gets Uno reversed himself as he's Bagon Head captured and confronted / threatened by Carlot Din Eider. Dogman is reunited with a blood-stained, thumb-rich Logan, who refuses to take his place as chief back. The whole crew meets up with the Hillmen and hatch a plot to trap Bethod between them and the Union Army. Pharaoh finds herself free to go wherever she pleases, but with no means to do so, so instead does everything she can to get under Baez's skin before leaving him alone to do his business. Zal resolves to marry Artie and give up his position in the army, but immediately removes that idea from his brain as he's double promoted to colonel and sent to deal with a rebellion. His lack of experience goes unnoticed due to the meddling of Baez, who effectively leads the army to a surrender of the Tanner. Upon returning to the city, he's met with a cheering crowd. Mood is quickly sullied by the sudden death of the king, who's in attendance.
Woo! That's a lot of stuff in a week.
A whole lot of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, this book just kind of goes. it's just like, hey, you know, before we might have taken a minute on any one of these things. Instead, what if we just did them all at once? what'd you think overall? What was your feelings about?
So we listened to this together, the first half of it.
Mm-hmm. In the car. And
I listened to the second half of it. Based on just our schedules and things that have been going on, I only got through this once and it was straight listening. Mm-hmm. But I actually, when I was going through like notes, forgot that the first half that we had listened to together was not something we already covered because there's so much shit that happens in the second half. It felt very, very dense. But I don't think I'd have it in any way.
Yeah, I was going to say on the other side of that too, we talked like a little bit about it in the car kind of as things were happening, which is very funny for a lot of reasons based on the first half of this episode. so we kind of got to break ground on it. So I definitely also get why that kind of, you know, fell out of the back of your head a little bit as well.
Maybe that's why. Yeah. Because we were actively talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah. A little bit different that way. Okay, cool. Well, we got a lot to cover, and we're in person, and we're starting a little bit late. So we're gonna get going here. With that, we start with our first chapter, So Much in Common. After much time away from her perspective, we return to Pharaoh for the first time in the last couple of weeks. We open with a chat between Kwai and Pharaoh, and Kwai points out that they are more alike than they are different.
I am still so in on my bet about Kwai. But even if I'm technically wrong with him being like a descendant of Gustrad or Gustrad himself, there's still something super fucked with him going on. I will say this exchange made me feel less like he's strictly a force of evil, though.
In what way?
In the way that he seems to have there's nefarious plans afoot, I think, but it seems like he has valid, good reasons for not trusting Bias. I'm just not sure where that aligns technically.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, I get that. There's something there that Kwai is hinting at immediately that's like, you know, obviously we have more in common, you know, than you might be aware. Which maybe hints at like a past relating to Kaul or, you know, any number of reasons why Kwai is maybe sticking around.
Right.
Yeah.
He insinuates that he's not able to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Which is curious to me.
Yeah. I mean, being in debt to a Magi, right? Probably isn't something you want to be. Right. Yeah.
Magi are...
Maybe. there's another initial note that I wanted to skip over, or not skip over here, but make sure that we didn't miss. It's so sad that we start this chapter off with Pharaoh missing nine fingers. Just an absolute gut punch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was really hoping something more would happen between them. And it sucks to get that pointed out more.
Yeah. And for her to feel that loss distinctly, right?
Right?
Like, she was kind of mad and aggro about that sort of thing, but it was frustration in the moment with the circumstances with which she found herself in, not at him necessarily. And so it's sad to see her also like lose that ability, you know, or that person that she trusted.
And I mean, I think that's just kind of her. It seems difficult for her to be mad at situations and not people, not direct that.
Right. Towards the
closest person
right.
happens to be there.
Yeah. So yeah, he suffered for nothing. She suffers for nothing. It's just sad, really. But before Kwai can really get into why they're similar, Baez returns and the apprentice quiets and sits at attention. Pharaoh and Baez then have a private conversation about her continued employment underneath him and how her staying is completely voluntary now, but that he does have a use for her, likely. Revenge for Pharaoh is still on the table.
I love that there's just such a great simplicity to the description of Pharaoh's perspective on the situation, how she's trapped, but she's not really trapped. And staying is by far her best option, but God damn it, does she not want to be here. She is a prisoner still, but it's not to anybody.
Right. And that is such a frustrating place for her to be in, because it's like the meme of let me in, right? But like, let me out. It's just sort of the reality of where she's kind of stuck. She is, you know, she wants just for a better life and a better future in general. But at the same time, the only way to get that is to extract revenge. And it's like, well, this guy's still the only path to that conceivably beyond, you know, the idiocy of just running in myself.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So,
and I'd argue it's the revenge is not the only path, but it's the only path that she seems. Will be satisfied.
Yeah. Yeah. That's for certain. Yeah, man. And there's a moment in which Pharaoh is instructed to leave after there's this conversation that she kind of has with Baez about that trap, like we're saying, where she's told to leave as Lord Isher is in, and Yoru arrives. That is just absolutely unhinged behavior that I totally love, where she's like inspecting every little last thing about the room. And then she goes, oh, you meant now?
Perfectly unhinged. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Correct way to describe it. This is part of what we listened together in the car, and
yeah,
we were cackling.
Yeah, it's such a small thing, but like, you know, checking the chair, sitting in it for a second, patting the armrests, and then like going over and inspecting the. It's so un-Pharaoh like as well, which is why it's like very, I don't know, lovely. It kind of gives you a sense of humor from Pharaoh as well, mm-hmm. which we know she has. Obviously, she's blistering. But worth pointing out, before that happens, I guess, shortly thereafter, Yoru introduces himself and explains to Baez that the plan remains in motion, but that there is more to be done for the old Magi. He says that Lord Isher is on his way, and there's a brief conversation that happens before we end our chapter that Pharaoh kind of overhears from the door. We know she can hear better than most people, mm-hmm. And so she kind of hears and listens in from a distance before actually taking off.
Yeah, it's been mentioned in the first book. Yoru's heterochromia.
Yeah.
But they made sure to make note of it here.
Just in case you forgot.
Just in case you forgot, or if it comes in handy to know later.
Does it?
Mm-hmm.
Could it?
Might.
We'll talk more about that later. I'll just, for everyone's sake right now, I'll just point out, I didn't write that in at all into any of our notes, just to ensure. I know. I'm just saying, as a note for eagle-eyed listeners, I'm very particular about these notes and not feeding PJ any individual detail that is a detail, and making him find it himself. And look, lo and behold, we have Yoru's eyes. We'll talk about it more later when we get to the Tanner.
Why would that be important?
I couldn't know.
How does that connect to Yoru?
I couldn't know.
Maybe they're brothers. They both have weird eyes.
Yeah, didn't say which eye was which, you know? It also just said they didn't match, which could it be? Who knows? Is it? Yeah. Weird. All right. With that, we move into Honesty, our next chapter here. We return to Jzal with an absolute banging chapter. This is a really lovely scene for a lot of reasons. He's kind of calming the person inside of him that felt like he didn't want Artie. He settled into loving her, and he's seemingly entirely changed from who he was when we initially met him. He's really kind of shifted in a big way. However minutely that may actually be by the end of this chapter, right. Let alone the end of the whole section.
Yeah. But even if we remove that sort of forward thinking from our perception right now, I've loved all the changes that seems to have befallen Jzal. But you get what I mean. But even here, he's really laying it on pretty thick for himself as far as energetically calling himself a changed man.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's him overestimating how much he's actually changed or trying to convince himself that he is indeed actually as changed as he wants to be. I'm not sure which it is, but it's certainly bluster to a certain degree.
A certain amount of it is bluster, just like a certain amount of it is how he convinces himself that he's loving Artie, right? I think he says it gets easier every time that he says it, right?
Yeah.
There's less pain or something like that.
I don't think he mentions pain, just that it gets easier. But it, either way, whatever it is, it's not perfectly genuine, but I do think he's gone through enough changes to notice it within himself. I think it could easily just be an overestimation.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. And I don't think it matters by the end of this chapter anyway.
That's fair. Yeah, I mean, the arguments to be had about what his character is are basically defeated by the end of this chapter. So like any debate over it really isn't worth it, because realistically, even the end of the week posits kind of the opposite question of like, maybe I do want this, actually. Mm-hmm. Maybe all that didn't mean anything.
Yeah.
Maybe I was just bored. Uh-oh.
I don't know if it...
Boredom is maybe the wrong description, but, you know, he does compare the plains to the city, and then, you know, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. It is worth noting, of course, too, that there's quite a bit of sexual encounter in this scene. There's a whole lot of that. Great commentary, I think, in a lot of different ways. Artie is hysterical. In addition to being perfectly seductive for Giselle, their flirtation is great. Getting interrupted is great. Mm-hmm. And sort of the way that that plays out on the whole is very funny.
Him walking at attention to the to the Vietnamese he's been called to.
Not sure if he's going to be able to make it out. Yep. It's all great. But we then come to the meeting with Veruz and many members of the closed council as he plans on resigning. And instead, he's met with intense praise for many deeds that he didn't commit while on his journey west.
I do love the lack of particulars.
Yeah.
In this praise. Like, it's all pretty vague.
The charge over the Bridge of Darnium, you know, and bedding the emperor's daughter or whatever. Like, there's so many small.
Oh, I don't know. I feel like I missed those ones. Again, only read through
the... I feel like those are the only two.
Right, which is why I felt like it was all just non-particulars.
But it's not particular anyway in the regards of, like, there's nothing... There's no substance to it either, right?
Oh,
like,
that's true, too.
Yeah. But it's particular in the way that it's a title, but it's not, you know, not real. Yeah, material. And it's funny, too, that Veruz kind of backs it up by saying, you know, regardless of, you know, kind of Giselle dismissing, and he says, well, one glorious rumor is worth 10 disappointing truths. Wouldn't you agree?
I guess we'll get more into it. I know we'll get more into it later, but this is the blossoming of my understanding of why Giselle from Baez. Playing the long game. But it could still be related to some lineage things.
Okay.
Because I was thinking about that some more as well. Mm-hmm. Something that still sticks with me for some reason from the first book, his relation to his father and his brothers, and how there's notable differences in their dispositions and from his estimation books. So I'm still hanging on to the idea that there's a known demonic lineage. I mean, literally demonic, right?
Yeah.
Or demons, not devils.
Devils. He says devils. You know, whatever. Like, In this case, there's not enough definition to delineate really from the two. So, Well, after according much praise for his actions in the West, he finds himself promoted to the rank of colonel. He almost immediately accepts, despite his honesty with Artie earlier about wishing to resign from the King's Own. He's then quickly assigned a task to put down the rebellion of the Tanner, a 40,000 peasant rebellion to be put down by our boy, and also our resident wizard, Baez, of whom claps him on the shoulder and goes, shame, my boy, I told you we would be working together again.
That also got me laughing really hard.
We giggled about that one for sure.
But man, this immediate double promotion, mm-hmm. like unprecedented double promotion, and then just bad thing upon bad thing upon bad thing. Oh, ending with Baez being also included. Oh, fuck.
The weight of responsibility immediately thrust upon him. Mm-hmm. Oh, how sad.
Yeah, it's, are you familiar with the term Italian air show?
No.
So, it is, there was an air show, like a tragic air show in Italy.
Okay.
Where it was going to be this beautiful event, and planes crashed.
Okay.
Which is horrible.
Yeah.
And then burning jet fuel sprayed over the crowd. So the idea of something with great expectation gets bad and then worse.
Wow. That is horrifying. That is a truly horrifying prospect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is Gisele's Italian air show right now.
Fair point. And especially like given the fact that he's like, 10,000 versus 40,000 sounds great. Also, I don't know how to lead people. Really.
And Baez is here.
And Baez is clapping my shoulder. Oh, God. Oh, no. I hate this man.
Maybe it's a little bit blowing things out of proportion to call it an Italian air show, but
I mean, it's prepping. Yeah, it's prepping for an Italian air show, that's for sure. The chapter ends with a wonderful, glorious confrontation between Glockta and Gisele because of his prolonged stays with Artie. Gisele is presented with the option to just leave, which is Glockta's preferred option, marry her, which he likes infinitely less, including the fact that this is because, especially, is you're fucking your friend's brother or sister, excuse me, which is, you know, bad, our mutual friend. Or he'll introduce him to some prolonged torture with some razors, a furnace, and culminating with a drowning.
Yeah, I think he refers to it as an intimate night with a furnace.
Yeah, right.
Glockta has proven himself time and time again, but seems to always ratchet it up, and I really do not want to meet this man in the street.
Yeah.
Any capacity.
He's got a new one every time you think he's out.
Yeah.
Every time you think he's down, he has a brand new torture method. Also, another torture method, PJ and I are sitting at the same table, and I just played footsie with him for a fucking second as I was trying to get space back.
with our collective bad feet,
yeah.
The wife pointed
right.
out.
Yeah. Yeah. My slammed ass toe jam.
Just ugly. I just have bad,
yeah, fair enough.
Feet.
Fair enough.
Apparently.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well,
I don't know why I brought that up.
Yeah. And I just said, yeah. So now we're here. Cool. All right. So with that, we move into, I think, our longest chapter of the week, Ghosts.
It was a pretty long chapter. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a beastie, beefy boy. I feel like it probably could have been two chapters. At the same time, it would have just been Logan chapter. So what's the difference?
It could have been a Logan chapter and a Dogman chapter. Like, the second half of this could have been from Dogman's perspective.
But I like that it's not, because it does... Yeah,
because it allows him to, like, go off into conversations with Shivers and...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It affords other opportunities to, like, seeing Logan as the Bloody Nine proper in the North, which is one of the things
yeah.
that I appreciate, is, like,
which
you know?
Is something distinct there he from is. Both Logan Nine Fingers. No, I don't... I don't know if he's the Bloody Nine proper here.
No, well, okay. Let me just clarify.
Yeah.
I mean, like,
as
we
a
see,
named man.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. As a named man of whom is feared for his reputation, this is really the first time that we've seen
right.
it. And especially, at the very least, seen it from his perspective.
I went into that like sentence thinking, oh, there's another term for the internal like
yeah.
sociopath that lives in his brain.
Right.
but no, that's also the Bloody Nine.
Right.
But I think those are two distinct things. His name as a Northman and then that entity that comes out.
Right.
Plays
yeah. Him. Yeah. Just like Darrow and the Reaper.
Yep. Actually, yeah.
Yeah. Truthfully, that's a comparison that I want to draw in the long term. We'll get there when mm-hmm. we get there at the end of the wrap up and kind of talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I see a lot of comparisons. Part of the reason that I drew them. And then also there's the connection of... Pierce Brown loves fucking Joe Abercrombie. Not fucking loves Joe Abercrombie. it's a little different.
There's some fan art.
Jesus. Don't rule 34 that, kids. Please. It's God, I don't want to get into like an AI discussion or anything like that. We've had plenty of them this weekend, but like rule 34 got so much easier.
I mean, it might actually be a rule now.
Yeah. Like a verifiable. I mean, it was already almost verifiable in its own way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Jesus. Anyway. All right, cool. With that, we will move into ghosts proper, finally. We cut to Logan having already made his way to Ufrith and presenting papers to a Union officer to be embedded into a unit to help fight against Bethod. He debates giving a fake name, but settles on using his real one, which I think is important in kind of the long run here for him.
Yeah. I think that's consistent. I think that's perfectly consistent. I don't think I would have expected anything else from Arsh. Great shooter,
right?
With nine fingers.
I don't disagree at all. Yeah, it definitely is the way to do it on the whole. And I'm down. It's just interesting that he debated it for a moment, you know?
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, I can't escape my name anyway, so like, why bother?
I think it could have been bad if he didn't give that name and then was recognized.
Yeah.
I think that wouldn't have ended the same way this.
I'd agree. I really love that he gets embedded into this unit. We see them kind of leave. You know, he's marching along. They make food at one point. They get the soup spoon out, and the guy doesn't think that he speaks common, of course. And he points at his mouth and has the ladle up, and he's like, yeah, I'll take some. And common, the guy freaks out, which is just great. It speaks to how good Logan is at, like, engendering people to him and to his cause. I particularly love the way that he befriends, you know, the rest of his unit as well in that moment through, like, quiet, unassuming humor, you know, bits about drinking, you know, and other things. Like, you don't want me to sing, I think, is the line that happens.
Yeah, it was, what, you'll kill us? He says, no, worse, I might sing. Or I'll kill you if you're lucky.
Yeah, I'll kill you if you're lucky.
I might sing.
I might sing instead.
Yeah. I appreciate his disposition, and his ability to win people over, like you mentioned. And I'm curious about how we haven't seen him use it as like an offensive tactic, but he's not that kind of man. As we just talked about, he's a straight shooter. I think he could be good at it if he wanted to, but at this, maybe he wouldn't be.
Yeah.
One part feeds the other part of it. Like his ability to befriend people is because of how genuine he is. His being genuine is what gives him the ability to befriend people. I don't think he can do that clandestinely.
I think that he did it a couple of times, or attempted it a couple of times in the Blade itself.
Did he?
Originally with like our first confrontation with Baez and Art, right? When he like blows up the whole forest.
Mm.
He's kind of chatting with those guys, like trying to, like, he's kind of buying time, but at the same time he's like, can I get at, like, is there a way out of this? And then he quickly realizes, no, there's not. They start fighting. Baez blows everything up, you know? So I don't think that his first act is violence innately, but it is a lot of times kind of like he said in Before They're Hanged, you know, you have to make a call. And the moment that you make it, you can't unmake it.
And he says something along those lines a couple different times today, mm-hmm. for this section.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's in particular with when he's going through the camp. But yeah. Speaking of, a couple of the boys are almost immediately injured after that joke by an ambush of arrows before Logan finds himself hunting down the men who accompanied. Who accomplished this, excuse me, throughout the woods. He picks them off quietly one by one before he awakens Crow, faces off with him, and eventually kills the man, the named man.
This whole scene and him stalking in the rain,
mm-hmm.
so well, like, cinematically written. It's so brooding.
Yeah.
But this named man showdown, the fact that we like, cut the black effectively.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious if that is an indication that the Bloody Nine came out to play. So, like, this is strictly Logan's perspective, not the Bloody Nine's perspective, which would be a change in format, but I'd be okay with it. It's well done. Or if it's just like, yeah, you can infer what happened. It's not a new fight, so I don't need to write it again.
I think it's a writing and editing choice, not a like choice on the side of anything narratively, if that makes sense. So one of the descriptions that's written on the front of the book, the one of the big quotes that's plastered all over it is, Akira Kurosawa meets Quentin Tarantino meets Game of Thrones or something like that.
Yeah.
Akira Kurosawa. I think it's on the front of the blade itself.
Oh.
It might be on the side of it as well, but it might be on the front of each of them.
So on the front, blade itself, for my copies.
Well, I have that copy.
Might be Joe Abercrombie is terrific from George R. R. Martin. Immediate, daring, and utterly entertaining from Jeff Vandermeer, and one of my top 10 favorite series of all time.
Okay, must be on the back.
Lord of the Rings is directed by Kurosawa.
Yeah, yeah.
From the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, and that
makes sense.
That is one of those, this is one of those moments when I feel like it is the most accurate, is when he's stalking through the woods. It is moody in a way that a Kurosawa piece is. These specific bloody violent actions are slow and methodical. You get this like shot where it's like, even if anyone wakes up, I think the quote is paraphrasing a little bit here, but even if anyone wakes up, they would only see the outline of one man and they probably wouldn't flinch at it. Like that is so distinctly Kurosawa in a way where it's like, and it's just visual storytelling, but he's communicating that through word, which is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the cut of not showing the fight and just showing the thumbs and the result of that is so Kurosawa. Like that is absolutely, it screams it.
Yeah.
It screams brilliant editing.
So good.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I want this.
Yeah, the man's magical.
I want this on screen.
Yeah, now you understand why I'm like, best served cold, best served cold. Like you haven't read it yet, but it doesn't matter because it's like, it's just a joke.
I get it.
Yeah. Like it doesn't matter the story. I just want to see something from this world rendered because Jesus Christ, does it lend itself to the format?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh,
just one such example, of course. So he returns to the Union encampment of sorts that they've dug out for themselves. I think he kind of insults it a little bit.
Pretty bad.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. He's like, okay, well, you tried.
And there's like a fucking puddle in the middle because they didn't dig it right.
Yeah, right. Nothing's correct. But Logan presents a bag of thumbs. You know, he's trying not to get shot, of course. He's like, hey, I got him. Here you go. From the Northmen, he killed to the leader, to which they all grimace, but they do continue upon the path.
Thumbs, man. that's a brutal thing to be shown.
Yeah.
But I think effective. I'd hope. I think I'd be convinced by it, but I would also act like they did and completely distance myself in every single way possible from this horrifying specimen of a human who's carrying 12 thumbs because he has two of his own.
Yeah, right. And there is that layered joke of like the guy without saying anything tries to just hand it back to him. He's like, no, I'm missing a finger, not thumbs. Like another just perfect joke into a cut into, you know, him approaching the Northmen and the Union encampment, as it were. Yeah. I really like it when they make it to the larger Union encampment. And of course, the person that we see there is a familiar face, the now Colonel West, of whom, of course, we've been following. But Logan hasn't seen him since the end of the blade itself. After they have a brief reunion and kind of talk through kind of what's happened a little bit here and there and sort of the state of things, he finds out that there's a detachment of Northmen that is fighting on behalf of the Union. And they're led by a man named Dogman, to which Logan smiles.
Yeah. That's the way it's described doesn't seem like a smile that I would be particularly comforted by if I were Colonel West. Seemed kind of ominous and unsettling.
Yeah, not quite malicious, but not quite non-malicious.
Yeah.
Like
I am still like I feel like I'm forever going to be surprised. And maybe it works out perfectly fine and maybe it doesn't fucking matter because it really probably doesn't, but the fact that Logan Nine Fingers, that connection never got made between West and the Northerners. Like they never had it never came up in any way that made them realize that they both met the same man before this. And it would have ruined the surprise. It would have ruined this meeting a little bit, but it's just I feel like that would have happened with how much they've been traveling together.
Yeah, that would have came up, you know, if it would have been a thing, right? Yeah. So not a once was it mentioned that Logan was alive. Yeah, as such. Makes sense. But Logan then approaches the camp, greeted by the sounds of his native tongue being spoken loudly and freely. He runs into a group of men asking to speak to Dogman. When he's finally recognized, this is the Bloody Nine in front of him. He's preparing in many ways for the worst. When he's greeted affectionately by Tul Duru, embracing him in a full hug, he exchanges a grin with the Dogman, a grunt with Grim, and some shallow words with Black Dao before he's caught up on all that happened in the Northmen's lives up until now. I love the way that I wrote that. I'm not going to lie. I like that.
Well done. Yeah, that was good. I fucking love Tul Duru.
Tul Duru is great.
I know it's partially because I'm big like he is, but it's also just because he's a fucking teddy bear that can and will kill indiscriminately.
Yeah. I think of the Northmen, I would definitely, put you into Tul Duru's shoes, I think, most immediately.
Yeah, maybe. Probably.
Probably.
Probably. Yeah. Yeah. I don't. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. He's just he's a teddy bear
for me.
Yeah. He listens. He's thoughtful. He speaks.
Yeah.
Yeah. He doesn't all the time.
If you hear our edits before I release these episodes, we do.
Quite a bit.
More than quite a bit.
These 370 times an episode, folks, on average. Sometimes more.
It's whatever. Yeah. It's fine.
You appreciate it in the edit. Don't worry. I mean, they appreciate that. Yeah.
These episodes would be like 15 minutes longer.
Legitimately, the us are 15 minutes.
For the 4 hour.
Yeah, right. Right. just a casual reminder that we did cut that 4 hour 20 recording session or whatever down to 320, 330, something.
320-ish.
Yeah. So I don't know. Because it was 340, and then I went, I think there's more. but yeah. Cool. Yeah, I love this meeting, this sort of return to form in all facets, right? Like obviously we spoke about Tull, but I do appreciate as well we actually see a blacker side of Black Dao, a more paranoid side, as now there is someone maybe perhaps who actually intimidates him in a real way. I don't think that he would run into Three Trees and wasn't like, I wouldn't say he wasn't intimidated, but he respected him. But he is truly just intimidated and blown out of the water by that.
Yeah. And I just want to circle back to what you just said. The idea of a return to form. Because it does feel like that.
Yeah.
But we've only ever known them separated.
Right.
So it's weird to feel a return to form.
Yeah.
To something we've never seen.
Yeah.
But right. It is well done enough that I do feel that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, because we've gotten to know them. We've gotten to know what they think about the Bloody Nine, you know, and we've variously, and sort of their opinions. Like Dogman missed him. Missed what he stood for and what he like believed in. So it sounds like he like knew him more closely, mm-hmm. which is why they exchanged kind of a knowing smile. You know, Tul Duru is more of like friendly with him because it's like, hey, you're my boxing buddy, you know, and yeah. That was kind of the vibe. Grim is Grim. and Black Dao feels intimidated, you know, by and large.
Put in his place a little.
Yeah.
Not
the big dog anymore.
Yeah. Not an unpredictable force of nature.
Yeah.
Again, looking at the Northmen's sort of views on death, it felt curt a little bit, but just talking like Three Trees, dead, poorly, dead. Mm-hmm. Like, that's all that needs to be said. And they take it as it is and he understands it. Like, yeah, I get that. Dogman's leader, that makes sense.
But yeah.
I like their sensibility. It is quite different from what we know as a society generally.
Yeah, yeah. It's more genuinely a meritocracy, if that makes sense. Like there's an understanding of skill and talent in a way that there generally isn't. There's not the same sort of like inflated ego. There are among many of the Northmen, but not among this group of Northmen.
Yeah.
You know, ego isn't quite so rampant.
And I appreciate your use of the term meritocracy or meritocracy, because I think we'll talk about it later, because I definitely got into it later.
Did you?
talking about the Union and Jizal.
Ah, yes. The true meritocracy of it all. Mm. I did want to read a quote here that I really appreciated. You know, all the Joe quotes rule. There's so many that are so good this week. This gets into what I was talking about earlier with Logan kind of recognizing something in himself. But just the way it used to be. And the worst of it was, now that Logan was recognized and he saw that fear and that horror and that respect, he wasn't so sure that he didn't like seeing it. He'd earned it all, hadn't he? After all, facts are facts.
I have a feeling that he was worried about this before. Like it was veiled.
Back of the mind contemplation. Yeah.
Maybe not veiled, but I think he was mostly focused on the Pharaoh sort of aspect of it and kind of trying to put that out of his mind. But I feel like this is something that he was actually afraid of when he was thinking about going back. Was the idea that he could slip back into enjoying putting the fear into the hearts of whoever looked at him just because of who he is. He mentions the scores that he has to settle in. I don't know. I don't know if it was a fear. I don't know if it was a driving force, like subconsciously. Like, yeah, I do kind of crave that or what, but I have a feeling that he was thinking about this previous to.
Yeah, I definitely think it was top of mind. And that's why I think it was also being debated when he was talking about introducing himself by name or not, you know, earlier. I think that is him reckoning with it to some degree or beginning to. Yeah, and the reality is that he wasn't going to be able to hide it no matter what he did.
He's a pretty notable and recognizable figure.
Yeah, he's got something that you can't undo, you know.
I mean, even without his hands.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, his scarred face
he's
and everything else.
He's fucking huge.
Yeah.
He's not as big as Tull, but he's fucking huge.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's scarred to shit in very obvious ways.
Right. Yeah. Yes, indeed. Then comes the confrontation with Rattleneck's youngest son, Shivers. It's a shocking one that our soft, helpful boy turned suddenly into a man with a grim expression, very cold and calculating, having met the man of whom killed his brother. There's something here that like truly sticks with him. He hates this man. He wants to see him dead. He's not going to do it right now.
There was a pretty haunting telling what Logan did to his brother.
Yeah.
And feels uncharacteristic as well.
Uncharacteristic of Logan?
Yeah. For having promised mercy. Like that doesn't feel like him for whatever reason. I don't know what the background is. War is hell, whatever you want to attribute it to. So I don't really blame Shivers for this level of I'm curious if Logan will ever come close to winning him over. I don't see it happening. I see there being a showdown at some point. But I'd be open to the idea of him somehow winning him over.
Yeah.
See.
Yeah. And it's not just him. It's worth noting, of course, there are many dozens others, cold frowns, nursing scores, I think is the language.
Even people that he doesn't recognize.
Like, right.
His influence reaches far beyond who he actually fought with.
I mean, he didn't know Shivers, you know,
he did.
Well, right. he knew of Shivers.
He knew the little kid. He's just grown up.
Yeah. I mean,
he didn't know him as Shivers. He didn't know him as a fighting man.
Yeah, but he also says, good to have a face on you after all this. Shivers says, good to have a face on you after all this time. Like, he never knew him. I think he just knew of a son. I don't think they ever saw each other.
That could be.
Yeah, not really.
That could be.
Yeah.
Or he was young enough that he didn't.
Right, that it didn't stick. Yeah. Yeah, the end here of this chapter was originally one of the ends that I had for the section that we read last week. So we're going to read through this point, basically. But Ghost of Somong itself deserves the time to talk about it. I particularly appreciate kind of the final paragraph here. Dogman had been right. Some wounds are best not picked at. Logan got up, his shoulders prickling, and walked back to the head of the fire, where the talk came easier. He no doubt Shivers wanted to kill him just as much as he ever had, but that was no surprise. You have to be realistic. No words could ever make right the things he'd done.
Yeah.
Including, you know, chopping a man's arms and legs off and nailing his head to a flag.
After promising him mercy.
Yeah.
Yeah. fuck. It's... I'm curious if he's right about thinking Dogman was right. Because I think this was the right move to go and confront him, go talk to him. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think it settled anything, but I think it did show Shivers that he was conscious of what he's done. And even if that doesn't change anything in Shivers' mind, it could in the long run,
yeah,
have some goodwill.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll see.
Yeah. Tough. Bloody Nine was a different man than even we knew. We knew that he was bad. We've known he was bad this whole time. But getting context on why and to what degree he was bad is a different thing altogether. Cool. All right. With that, we move into our drink segment here. PJ, you're drinking what I'm drinking.
Yeah, you... So, I was finishing up notes before recording, and Crossland raided my liquor cabinet. And
with your permission.
Well, yeah, I told him to, but he made us a drink. So, Cross, would you like to... First of all, this Hibiki is one of the best whiskeys I have ever had in my life.
Yeah, and for a $100 bottle, it is incredibly good.
It's like, an expensive bottle of whiskey. But
I have scotches that are more expensive.
There are lots of more expensive bottles of whiskey. And like more expensive that I've had that pale in comparison to this. Like this sits up there with that Seagrass.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
That you guys got me.
Mm-hmm.
Birthday.
I'll once again say that is the one gift I didn't contribute to out of the whole gift groups, but that's because they got you, because I was here and bought other things and hung out.
Yeah. Regardless, that the D&D group got.
Yes. No stolen valor here.
That's 2.5 times more expensive than this.
Mm-hmm.
Is also one of the best whiskeys I've ever had in my life. This is right in the same ballpark. A lot more affordable. I know $100 expensive for it, but this I think is something that I'm going to seek out and going to try to have stock perpetually. I don't think I'll drink it often, but I will share it with people as much as I can. It is some cross between an Irish whiskey and a bourbon somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a really, really weird... I've never had a Japanese whiskey.
You've never had a Japanese... Okay, so just for like context for people that are listening, Japanese whiskey is a combination of Irish and Scottish methods.
Okay.
So it's, generally speaking, it's got some of the palate and peatiness of a Scotch, sometimes depending on what they're going for.
I'd say that for this one.
Well, I think it kind of has a little bit of a Speyside note in there, which is like there's a little bit of like the salt. That's why I personally really like Japanese whiskey, is because it is adjacent to the type of Scotch that I love the most, which are the lighter Scotches, the Speyside or the Highland. And so there's just that tiny note. But this, it is so subdued. And I think that they really played into the more Irish direction, you know, to your point. But it is round like a bourbon. And I think that's kind of the shared malt characteristics of bourbon and Scotch. But
there's just an inherent sweetness and almost like honey character that you generally get out of Irish.
Yeah, right.
Phenomenal. I will be buying myself a bottle of this.
Yeah. Suntory is great in general. Even their like standard whiskey for like $40 is, or 36 or something like that, is incredible. It beats out most other whiskeys of that weight class by like a mile. But it's so eminently drinkable that also like sometimes you just keep pouring and you're like, oh my God, what have I done? Which is also how I feel about sake. So
yeah.
So yeah, I'm very excited that we found this at, man, the story behind finding this bottle as well is so funny. I used to, walking home between school and where I lived, there was a Tom Thumb that is now also a liquor store.
It's just this like locally owned gas station now.
Mm-hmm.
Like just a one-off gas station. But I believe one of the, like this, like it's a family that owns, yep, owns it. I think it's
always
son.
The, yeah.
That his, like, This liquor store is his like total passion project.
Makes sense.
And it is an insane whiskey selection. In just this, like, you would never expect.
It's so unassuming.
It's so unassuming.
They had the other, so there were two Japanese whiskeys that I've been seeking out in North Carolina. Harder to find. I can request orders, but I feel weird about it. I don't know. They have to like order a whole case of it, and that's, I don't know. I feel weird about it. For whatever reason. And so they had Hibiki, and they also had, it starts with a T, like Tenetsuki or something like that, which are two incredible whiskeys that I'd been considering for a long time. They had this here, but the Tenetsuki is like $150. Hibiki is like $100. I was like, okay, well, I'm going to spend $100 on the whiskey that I know is really good from other people's reviews, and 100% worth it. At the gas station that I used to buy Vaults from,
like the soda.
Vault soda on my way home from track or swimming in the winter or soccer.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
That is my secret whiskey spot whenever, yeah, I want a good bottle of whiskey. That's where I go.
So funny. So yeah, hometown liquor store, apparently incredible. The cocktail that I make, I'm not going to dwell too much on this. I mentioned this in the last show. I've been trying to play around with like gin, tiki drinks a little bit more, in part because that was what my drink was. My drink was like brandy, whiskey, and gin, at my party. And so I've just been thinking about kind of building in that direction. You had Orjo because we had Infantes over the weekend, which is maybe the best cocktail that we've found, ever. Maybe.
It's so easy and it's so good.
It's so ridiculously tasty.
It's widely.
It's a format like an old fashioned or a sour.
But yeah. It's also it's sweet enough and simple enough that a wide range of audience, a wide range of drinkers will like
that. Yeah. Yeah. Regardless of whether or not you do it with any kind of tequila or with rum, or, you know, I did one with gin and that was great. So. This is basically it's a gin forward cocktail. This is the double version that I made, just for everyone's sake, for the recipe's sake. That's what I wrote down. So this would make two, but it's 4.5 ounces of gin, 1.5 ounces of overproof rum. In this case, I think you had Palms or something like that.
Yeah,
I think
it's Palms 151.
Yeah. Which was actually great in this cocktail.
Really
genuinely shocked. 1/2 ounce of green chartreuse. So 1/4 ounce per. 2 ounces of lime, 2 ounces of Orjo, dash of Angostura. You'll note this is pretty similar to the cocktail that I made last week, except for the rum and the green chartreuse, because I didn't have any. Because I used instead, what was it? Saint Germain and, well, I used absinthe to fix it. The thing that I subbed in for rum wasn't rum. I think it was vodka. I think I used vodka to back it. So basically subbing that out and mixing it up a little bit. But yeah, again, Orjo, super easy to make. Just use almond milk and sugar and make a simple syrup effectively. And yeah, throw in a dash of orange blossom.
Yeah, orange blossom water, rose water, which comes in a 2-pack. Like they come in a pack.
I don't generally add rose water. I do orange blossom and I do
almond.
Yeah.
We talked about it last week.
Right.
I, for whatever reason, I tasted this. You didn't tell me anything about what was in it. And I continued to get this note even after knowing what was in it. I got citrus, but I primarily thought it was like a weird, like tuned down version of orange. And I wasn't sure like what I was getting. And I think it's a combination of the orgeau, obviously the lime lending itself to a lot of the citrus notes of it, but I didn't get like overpowering lime. I got orange. I think there's some orange peel or something in the blend in the green chartreuse.
Or
it has to be.
Or in the overproof. I bet it's in the overproof. In the overproof. I think it's in the overproof.
It's a 151 though. Like so many of those, like so many of those notes go away when you get to that high a proof. But that is a good 151.
It's a the bottle's unassuming.
It's really unassuming.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Just whatever combination of all of it screamed orange to me for some reason.
Yeah, it does have a little bit of a, I would say like a tang to it. And I don't mean like tang soda, but like there's that sort of, there's a tang.
Yeah. I liked it. I really, really appreciate this cocktail.
Yeah, no problem. To follow that up, we are both having Castle Danger Brews, which is from what?
Two Harbors, Minnesota.
Two Harbors,
so
north of Duluth.
They were from Castle Danger, Minnesota.
Yep.
Which is the coolest fucking name of any town in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. But they moved to Two Harbors. I got a 12-pack, mixed pack, because we were
bachelor party.
Yeah, yeah, it was their like summer pack or whatever. So I got their orange cream ale. Crossland got their grapefruit. Decent beers.
Solid. I really like the grapefruit. Yeah. There are a few, like grapefruit, anything is like hit or miss. Pretty hardcore. I'm a big fan of grapefruit, so I love when it's good. This is great.
Yeah. And the orange, so their cream ale is like their biggest seller and like one of the biggest like Minnesota local craft beer sellers. And then the orange is pretty overpowering. So I'm not gonna lie. It's a good beer. It's a lot of orange. I might tone that back a little bit.
Yeah. Fair enough.
It's decent.
Cool.
Crushable.
Imminently crushable. Great for the boat. And that was kind of the idea with the whole pack. So
yeah, marketed for it.
And you're going to Alaska for a week, so we weren't going to like stock your fridge with anything crazy or buy shit because, you know, you're going to go vacation. Cool. All right. So with that, let's go into Bad Debts. We open our chapter with a moment ripped straight from Snatch as Harlan Marlowe calls to meet Glockta in a pig pen. As he calls up his own personal history and Glockta goes, "Oh no, not the personal backstory." Like a bad villain giving a speech, his thugs move in to kill our cripple, and Glockta's embarrassed for them, frankly.
Yeah.
He finds the whole thing pretty demeaning. I think to quote, "I'm not upset that you tried to kill me, but to make such a pathetic effort at it, we're professionals, Moro. It's an insult that you thought that this might work."
Yeah, he's surprised but not unprepared, I think was another quote.
Yeah.
As soon as the pink pens were mentioned. And maybe it's because of how many times I've watched Snatch in my life.
Sure.
But as soon as they were mentioned, I knew they were where this was going.
You know, like that, yeah. You were subbing in Glockta's name for Turkish every time Harlow was speaking.
A pig.
As mentioned, he's embarrassed and he thought that this would work. Both of the thugs are quickly dispatched and Harlan himself is killed, his throat slit, as the trio of Vitari, Frost, and Severard take them all out independently in their own fashions.
And there's some quibbling between Glockta and Severard.
Yeah.
you couldn't have just choked him out.
Like, yeah.
Same result, right?
Right. Yeah, it's such a great scene. Again, just reminding us of sort of the trio of practicals. I'm curious, how do you feel about Vitari now? Like, there's been some time. I don't think we really talked about it too much last week as to sort of the speculation with sort of Severard following around, finding the family, etc. But yeah, that was a couple of weeks ago. But
it was a couple of weeks ago.
It was in before their
Nothing's really happened with it since then. It made a lot of her click. It made me understand her a lot better, and kind of quelled the conspiracy theories that I had for rooting around in my brain. So for the most part right now, I'm feeling trusting of Atari in relation to Bacta.
Cool. All right. Sounds good. So this all goes very well for them, of course. But then walking home, click, clack, tapping home. Glockta is abducted and questions who it could possibly be due to all the people that he's angered and that could potentially want him in this
moment. A lot of different people.
Yeah, he's like, could it be the House of Valentin Balk? Could it be that fool Yoru Sulfur? Could it be your way? Could it be
Salt of
whoever
Felt.
The fuck? Salt? Yeah, could it be? It could be anyone. But it turns out to be the one that he'd freed and let run, none other than Carlotte Dan Ida, who has regrown some of her hair, of whom's bruises and scars and other damages from torture are fading. There's a lot there. And this is a very interesting conversation on the whole. I think I kind of want to just leave this to be really freeform because it is kind of the rest of the chapter and there's a lot there. But it kind of surrounds her place in the Union now. Glockta internally thinks this is another knife that I have to juggle, which is funny because Jesus could even juggle like a single ball. What do you make of her sudden reappearance and place in affirming Yulwe's message of the Gurkish fleet?
In general, I think it makes sense to me. It's smart of her, mm-hmm. I think. She never really struck me as somebody particularly sentimental.
Sure.
So, like, the idea that, oh, like, Glockta saved my life when he should have killed me means I should probably listen to him. It probably never crossed her mind. She has a sharp mind for negotiation because she has to. And because, like, she wouldn't survive as the leader of the merchant guild. Or I can't remember their specific name in that city. So, smart mind for negotiation. Not sentimental, recognizing leverage and acting on it seemed inevitable. Like she recognizes that she has all of the cards between Glockta and herself. So he's fucked if she ever comes to light. Yeah. She could die, I guess, but he would go down with her. So she, I don't think she has really a valid fear going into this.
Sure, yeah, and she's the one holding superior cards, by all accounts.
Yeah,
as she holds the superior hostage
and all of her contacts.
Yeah, yeah, real knee slapper. Yeah, it was pretty bad. It was pretty bad. What do you think she's going to do? What do you think? What predictions lie for Carlotte Dan Ida and her interaction in the story here for you?
It's an interesting
kind of twist
conversation yeah. that they have because it's simultaneously a threat,
mm-hmm.
Not really,
but kind of, yeah,
and a warning.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. It's a fully separate entity that Glockta has to maintain a relationship with, like Valentin Balk.
Mm-hmm.
Because pissing them off has dire risks for him, potentially.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. She's questioning, like, she has questions about the king to be situation as well,
yeah,
throughout this. So that's a whole nother, he's gonna have to thread the needle pretty hard. Probably not though, because Jizal the dark horse is riding right now. we'll talk about that later.
in but a moment. Good, sir. I did want to also bring up, and this is a minor detail among the details that you'd mentioned or otherwise, but at the end of the pigpen scene before he's left kind of alone, he does mention to Severard that asks if he still has the house near the sewers. He does, and so they again agree to set up their little house between two dentists, as it were. So
God, I hope Severard's been living there. Just living like a king.
Yeah.
in some defunct mansion.
Just enjoying it, you know, as he should, as the guy should. Yeah. Cool. All right. With that, we move into Ragged Multitude, a Ragged Multitude. We then return to Jizal in a tent on a crested hilltop, looking down upon the rebels all lined up in their various rows and truly menacing. This is not the ragtag band that he was led to believe. This is an organized force.
This is an army.
Yeah, this is, by all accounts, is an army. Now, given, let's remember, the Union army men, as Logan looks at them, are not very good. So, like, Jizal's perspective on how good they are maybe isn't the best, but, like, still, for at the very least internal Union standards, this is approaching army-like in a lot of fashions, which could imply that the Union is closer to a lightly trained militia than is a proper army. But, you know, neither here nor there.
Yeah, I mean, the King's Own itself is part, like, detail duty and part, like, army regiment.
Right.
So, like, they're well trained, but they're not, like, they're splitting duties a little bit.
Right.
So, I don't know. I don't know what to make of them. I feel like there's probably a better, there should be a better trained, like, elite task force. Maybe we'll find out that there is one, but doesn't seem like it. Seems like King's Own is kind of the pinnacle of
it. Sure. Cool. Yeah, it does. It does have that feeling. He's assisted, of course, in the moment by Major Opker. And having completely failed up into his role, really isn't sure what he's doing here.
This is the thought on meritocracies or meritocracies. Yeah. Talking about
meritocracy. Meritocrates is the guy who invented the meritocracy. So,
really,
no, absolutely not.
I would have believed it.
Yeah, no.
Like, if merit had derived from.
I have to double check now just to make sure. Yeah, no, it's not. Okay, just making sure. I was like, you know, this isn't a... Anyway, okay. Yep. I just wanted to make sure that it wasn't a thing where it was named after someone, because a lot of those things are. And I know a lot of, like, I know a lot of Aristotle and Plato just in the back of my mind. And so it's just like, wait a minute. Is it?
It was believable enough.
Yeah, that, like, well, I thought it was a joke, and I delivered it, you know, very seriously. Like, I knew that it was a joke, but yeah. Anyway. Yeah.
Anyway, meritocracies always work out. Intended.
Right? Clearly.
Yeah.
Clearly.
Never a veiled nepotistic cesspool or anything.
Never.
Oh.
Definitely not in a system that favors a royal bloodline or any sort of superior class-like structure on top of that.
Right.
Yeah.
No,
it's definitely super merit.
They're just the best.
Yeah, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The quote here that I really appreciate too is he, Jizal, had discovered early in his military career that if one has an effective and experienced officer above him, coupled with an effective and experienced officers below him, one need do and know nothing. And you know what? there's something to it, isn't there?
There's a lot to that.
This is definitely the office space middle manager thing of what exactly do you do here? And Jizal fits right into that slice of
slots right in.
Yeah. What do you do here? Very true. We see three soldiers split off from the massive force beneath them after he delivers the orders of what to do. And he's like, some sort of columns, and Opker kind of gives him a sideway glance like, sure, I don't know what the fuck that means. But we do see forces break off, and we come then to the negotiations with the Tanner. Jizal presents the offer of lower taxes from the Closed Council and some other light concessions, but nothing that they seriously wanted on offer that the Tanner and his two compatriots were seeking. And despite Holst and Hood proclaiming that they should seek more and shouldn't settle for this, the Tanner agrees that it will do.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Tanner and his very suspicious eyes.
Yes.
Note of that. Is it...
Make note.
Is this worth betting?
What do you think?
I it feels well enough laid out, and like obviously enough laid out, especially here, that it's just a nod to the audience. But I know that you and I read things a lot more like intensely. Mm-hmm. It just feels so obvious here that this is your room.
I will reiterate, there is a reason that I kind of broke up the chapters the way that I originally did, because it would give a week between and it wouldn't be so obvious given the Pharaoh to this.
It's making me think back and try to remember if there are other characters that we meet.
Oh, weird. Were there?
I don't know.
Oh, do you not
I
know?
I feel like there were. But I don't know.
Wild.
I don't know if I'm just thinking of our meeting with Yuru.
No, I will confidently affirm for you that there have been a couple.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So what's up? What's up with Yoru then?
Well, I mean, obviously, like, I don't know if shape shifting is the right term for it, but like that's his domain is appearance.
Okay.
Shimmering.
I would say that this is what I want you to bet on, if that makes sense. Like, not betting whether or not this is Yoru. But what is Yoru, or what's going on with Yoru?
Okay. Yoru is an infiltrating sort, force wielded by Baez, generally, probably, to silently take out and replace opposing forces or opposing characters.
Okay. So you think he killed the Tanner, basically, took the spot. So like the rebellion was real and killed the Tanner.
Oh, that's an interesting thought too.
I didn't strictly mean it that way. I just meant like, you know, like, yeah.
But I wouldn't put it past Baez to entirely fabricate an uprising. In order to quash it with an installed kernel. No, it feels genuine enough that there was a removed from
squashed,
replaced by,
and so he just can shapeshift.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other option would be possession.
Okay.
But I'm going with shape.
Okay. Cool. We know that he's a graduated magus, so like he is. That's something that's introduced in the Pharaoh chapter. Is like he's not one of the 12, but he is a magi of whom actually graduated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Give some insight into Bethod's wish.
Cowrib. We talk about
what path she might take.
Right. One with the long eye. Cool. Yeah. Tanner just fucking agrees, which, you know, pisses off everyone else. Everybody dislike this. Yeah. Everybody dislike this. And Opker leaves to arrest the other two leaders after they storm out. The Tanner says that he'll give a big speech to the little people. And Baez reminds Jizal that it's important to embellish the story as much as fucking possible. Especially the negotiations.
Yeah. Hearing going forward is where I really started focusing on my thoughts that Baez was looking to install Jizal as king. Legitimately.
Mm-hmm.
To be voted in. And I feel like I mentioned that as like a passing sort of possibility before.
You did in the wrap up.
Yeah,
I will say because people commented upon it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because of his sort of... No, that was... Yeah. There have been things, but this, it's starting to get more and more obvious.
Yeah. Yeah, perhaps. Perhaps.
Perhaps.
Perhaps. Oh, was that a burp to emulate Burr in his burpy tummy?
Yeah, it was on purpose.
You planned that?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. All right. Excellent. All right. So with that, we get to our penultimate chapter here. Beloved of the Moon. Man, fucking catchphrase aplenty in this chapter. Can't wait to talk more about it. So we return to Dogman's perspective, and things have not been going well on the path to Carlion. Trying to find their way there, the Union forces have thrice been repelled by different maulings, as they call it. Two directly from Polder, one from Croy, and there's like a couple of things that they've considered doing with Burr's forces directly as a part of sort of the marching orders as they were, but nothing immediately appears to have worked. So he circles the wagons with his closest members of his crew and discusses the failings of the Union and their impending errand that they're going to have to run on their behalf. While confronting both Dow and Logan, there's an overlying theme of things don't change as they speak about each other respectively as well. There's so much in this chapter that is meaty as a comparison between Dow and Logan. But yeah, curious on your thoughts on the Union and then maybe Dow and Logan.
As far as the Union goes, they're trying, but they're not doing it. Like, they don't belong here. It seems pretty obvious. There's some hope for their position, I think, towards the end of this chapter, but it feels really bleak from all directions. They don't fucking belong here in any way. The scene between Logan and Dow.
Yeah. Do it up.
That was super tense.
Mm-hmm.
And I really appreciated the explanation that Logan gave. Sort of, had he not acted the way that he did and really dropped the hammer and nipped this in the bud, that he'd be opening himself up to disgruntled, wronged men who feel emboldened by the bloody nine that backs off a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, consistency is pretty fucking key as far as what we've understood Logan to be. And that can drop both ways, good and bad. I do want to note, though, that my beloved Tal Duru seems to have slipped his spine a little bit and, like, wormed his way through the grates of the wrath of Logan Nine Fingers a little bit, because he was right there with Dow, somehow didn't catch the focus, it kind of avoided it, because Logan must have heard it, but maybe Dow was the better target for this sort of display of force.
Mm-hmm.
But all to be a little bit more of a stand-up man.
Even then, though, I think he is. I think he's more stand-up than you'd expect, right? So, like, there's a little bit of a conversation. He specifically calls him out. You know, Dow says, "Just when the Bloody Nine bring anything but, just when did the Bloody Nine bring anything but death along with him?" And Tull pushes back, saying, "Steady now, you owe him. Remember, we all do." And that's, I think, that's more stabilizing. Like,
yeah,
he's more of a mediator, I would say, okay, than like a negative force. But he's not reaffirming positive things so much as he is just stopping the negative, if that makes sense. And Dow's responsive. There's a limit on what a man should owe, I reckon. You know, where's he been? He left us up in the valleys without a word, didn't he? He left us to the Flatheads and pissed off halfway across the world. Who's to say he won't wander off again if it suits him, or go over to Bethod, or set to murder over nothing, or the dead know what? You know, and Tull responds, you know, that was a long time ago. Things changed. And Dow looks at him and says, no, they don't. tell yourselves that tale if it makes you sleep easier, but I'll keep one eye open. I can tell you that. It's the Bloody Nine we're talking of. Who knows what he'll do next?
Yeah, you're right. I'm not even talking about the tall thing,
you know, specifically.
No, but that does kind of recontextualize it a little bit. Man, this is why I like reading the book.
Yeah, I get it.
Multiple times before we start recording. Yeah, I just had this sort of immediate reaction. Tall wasn't what I wanted. But that kind of changes my.
Again, more of a neutral force, but I don't even care about the neutral force thing. It's more that, like, this idea, again, that is being reinforced of things don't change. People are the same. And Logan proved that in his own right. Jazal's proving that in his own right in the way that he's accepted the victories mm-hmm. and otherwise. You know, like, all of these things are just piling up to basically, you know, roll it in our faces of, do people really change? Can they change?
Mm-hmm. And I think even with Jazal falling back into the sort of glory and power hungry Nepo bigot that he'd been in the past.
At the very least, he's not a Nepo bigot. You know?
I think there's still changes that mm-hmm. he's made. There's still an evolution to him. Even if it's two steps forward, one step back.
Right.
Still a net positive. So I'd argue that we see that with Logan too, looking back on what he did to Shiver's brother. Doesn't seem like him right now. Like, doesn't seem like the Logan that we know. So hypothetically and hopefully there has been a change there, even if it's not the core central like being that he is, like the surrounding.
Totally. Yeah, I definitely get that. Yeah, not fully disagreeing with that. Just saying, like, there's something to Dao's thesis.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. So from there, we then meet the Hillmen when they go on their errand. After a rogue arrow flies and rogue scent hits the Dogman nose, there's an uncertainty in what is to be done here. We find a couple of children that emerge from the trees. And it becomes clear that we're meeting the Hillmen Krummic Ifail, the chief of the Hillmen, this sort of segment of Northmen that we've heard rumblings of over the course of the last couple of novels. Yeah. And Krummic's name, I think, has even been said once before, but not really given the weight. Yeah. But now we're here with the Hillmen, the weirdos.
Jesus Christ, man. Like, is there any end to the list of just absurd, insane, powerful men? God for
I mean, probably not, because they're all named,
right,
you know.
Good point.
But the Hillmen are different. Like, they're in the way that Krummic speaks, adjacently feels like Appalachian, you know, compared to the Northmen, right? Like, he's got a flair and a tongue, and I think some of that is also like the impression that Pacey gives him. But like there's an affectation there that is very different.
Yeah, I'm curious what I really want to know what sort of direction Pacey gets, if he gets any at all.
He doesn't. Yeah,
it's so good, man.
There's an interview at the very end of this that you're definitely gonna want to listen to. That is Pacey and Abercrombie and an interviewer talking, and it is dynamite. That's where Leanna was talking about.
Yeah.
The other day.
But like this. This section specifically, there's a couple scenes with so many voices,
mm-hmm.
and they're kept straight. They're so well, like, they're so distinct from one another. And it is, I want to know if he's reading it straight or if he's taking like passes in each character that gets stitched together. Like, I'm so curious the process by which this man recorded this book. Because it's astonishing. It's so well done. Mm-hmm. And just thinking about his acting chops, knowing that he was, like, seeing him in House of the Dragon a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck, dude. Like, why isn't he in fucking everything now?
Right, right. Why isn't he Glockta in the eventual adaptation? You know? Unfortunately, he's not 30, which I think is a limiting factor.
Yeah, but...
Make him the king. Make him fucking buy it.
We have to send him to the the supposed conspiratorial elite centers that de-age people and turn him into a 30-year-old so he can be Glockta.
On what is it, like the upgrade program or whatever the fuck it's called? I forget the guy's name. Brian something or other, the wealthy man with that does the crazy fucking dieting and like tried the blood transfusion thing for a hot second, whatever else. Yeah. Yeah. We'll put Stephen Pacey through it just to ensure that he is the right age. I'm sure he'll appreciate that and definitely follow through. He'll eat his super fruit, whatever the hell it was called.
We need to get him in league with the lizard people. They'll make him younger. I know they have the technology.
Speaking of, where are those lizard people at? We could use you right now.
Yes.
Please intervene actively. I'm begging you. Anyway. Oh, God. All right. So, Chromicky Fail ends up the smartest man from this side of the hill, I guess, lays out his plan and thought process as clearly as he can. They've got a chance, given Bethod's ire, to catch them and fight some of them here in the hills if they plan carefully enough with the Union. Meanwhile, this whole time, while this conversation is going on, he's got two sons and a daughter, of whom he keeps referring to as three sons. The daughter gets pissed, drops the hammer a bunch of times, just carrying around his fucking weapons. Crazy to have like just an arsenal that's just children. I don't know, like all of this is crazy. What did you make of the whole mess?
I don't know. So before this, mm-hmm. when I was listening to this book, I was also making us pizzas.
Yes.
And I don't know if you looked out the window while I was doing that.
You were running around a lot. So I
was running around a lot, but I almost dropped your pizza.
Yeah.
Laughing at this guy talking to his daughter. I almost lost your pizza on the cobblestones.
Fuck.
God, that was so funny.
Yeah.
I really like this guy. I like his plans. I like his sort of
messy attitude.
Yeah, but it's well placed.
Right.
Like, it's earned.
Yeah.
Seemingly, like clearly, he has earned the confidence that he has both in size and strength and whatever. Presumably track record.
Right, right. Not unfounded.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to dealing with this guy. I'm not looking forward to necessarily lying with him from the perspective of our characters.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how well that'll go in the long run, but in the short run, right now, like they're suggesting, fuck yeah.
Yeah. I dig it. I agree mm-hmm. with you. I get it.
Like, there's also some very interesting comparisons, like we've been talking about, to Red Rising that at some point I think we could talk about.
Yeah, I feel like when we get into that wrap up with Mike, I think that'll be a good time to talk about it because he also adores, I mean, obviously he had Howlerpod on to do like a whole Red Rising read-along thing every month for 6 months leading up to Lightbringer. So, of course, he loves Red Rising. So I think that'll be a good time to kind of talk about the duality there.
Yeah.
So cool. That's where I imagine we'll fully kind of discuss it. So, all right. To kind of round out this chapter, there's a number of different notes. This is a long chapter. There's a lot that happens in it. If you have anything else to bring up, please feel free to. But Logan is called Beloved of the Moon, but also points out that he knows Cowrib and is aware of her long, high, and dirty tricks. It's interesting as well that Krummick points out that... you know, it kind of points to this sort of magical thing and talks about witches and witches, wizards and wizards, and kind of waves his hands as though they're funny things that don't really exist at the same time as being like, yeah, she's got like dirty
the moon
magic.
Told me that you're here.
Yeah. Yeah. The moon, but the moon told me that you're here. I'm not crazy. You're fucking crazy. That shit, crazy. The moon, really good. I love the moon.
The moon, real. Right there.
Right there.
Moon. You can see it. I'm to that point. I'm curious if that is a euphemism or a literal thing. Like, did he literally get the information that Logan was in town from the moon, or were there scouts?
Yeah, or is he crazy? Alternate point.
I don't think that has to be an or.
Yeah, good point. Good point. There's one A, one B, two A, two B, which includes crazy. Those are the Bs. Yeah. But they discuss the plan. They split off from Krummick for a moment or two. They discuss the plan. And Dogman, of course, is the one of whom steps up and agrees to make the plan because Logan is not the leader and he fully cedes this. There's no part of him that wants that and understands and follows Dogman, which is so great.
Yeah. I don't know what I think of this situation right now with Dogman. Because everything was like the whole conversation was between Logan and Krummick. So I think it'd be incredibly difficult for Dogman to disagree with going along with this plan, even if he wanted to. He's kind of been biased into this situation. Maybe not. I don't know. I should know what his brain is thinking because we're in his perspective. Or no, we're not. Are we in Logan's perspective?
This is Dogman's.
It is Dogman. Okay.
Yeah.
So I think we'd probably get some more trepidation from him if that was the case. But I could see him feeling forced into a decision in the direction that Logan wanted. So I'm hoping that maybe we see a time where Dogman actively goes against and chooses to take a path that Logan does not want to go down.
Sure.
Just to prove that he has some autonomy.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
But for now, I'm going to be a little bit trepidatious about that until...
Yeah, I think as sort of not a full, like, this is by no means a disagreement, but I'm curious if you think that Logan would rebel against a Dogman decision.
No, I think he'd totally go along with it. Okay. I think Logan is genuinely wanting to follow Dogman.
Dogman might not be confident enough in himself.
Exactly. That's where I'm going with it.
Yeah. 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 Okay, cool.
Yeah.
That's what
I'm
not
saying. Logan is trying to, like, I guess drawing the bias comparison, more a joke than an actual comparison.
Sure.
I think Logan would legitimately follow Dogman, whatever he decided to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Dogman is intimidated by leading Logan.
The Bloody Knight. Yeah. Fair enough. All right. Anything else on Krummicky Fail, the Hillmen, and Dogman?
Not right now, I don't think.
All right. With that, we move into our final chapter of the week. And boy, is it a short one. literally 3 pages. Mm-hmm. flowers and plaudits. We return to our boy dressed in his military finest at Baez's request as he is set to march in to the Agriant and meet the people. He's caught contemplating who he was before and what he is in his head now that he's back in Adjua on the whole and in the military and everything else. Had the planes really changed him? Or did he need to just actually aspire to be more, to live for more in many ways? All this occurs while Baez vaguely lectures about Herod the Great and the kings and whatnot in the background. you're not sorry.
Specifically, he's talking about, like, what kings are supposed to do.
Right.
As in, like, a lesson.
Mm-hmm.
and like preparation.
How do the king be though?
For when Jazal is installed as king after Baez kills the current one from horseback, makes him shit and or piss himself from the safety of his saddle. I think that's what happened.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
We'll see. Maybe we won't. But I'm sure.
Maybe we won't see, but I know.
But I know. Too okay. Too fucking coincidental.
Yeah. Nothing else? Just on the rest of it?
No, just a little heart explode. we all have to look closer for shimmers. He's really got to look at shimmers.
He's never noticed them before. Logan's the only one who saw him.
That, really?
Yeah. I think Pharaoh did, actually, technically, as well, at one point. But Jizal, I don't think, ever noticed anything. Yeah. Jizal has felt sick. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I never took note of whose perspective thing. The shimmers come from.
Yeah. Tiny little thing. But I do want to point out, though, within kind of this whole thing, just sort of the thought process that he's rolling through, right? This is where we kind of talked a little bit about this earlier within the Artie chapter, but this is where he's rolling back even more of those things and kind of contemplating what exactly it could be, could mean, what does he do, you know?
There's a lot of back and forth here because he does kind of rubber band back to some of those.
Yeah.
Those
he's like, I could just be with Artie.
Yeah. And I, bias is at the core of this too. Like really pushing him to be the confident leader, confident champion that he is coming into this. Because it's so quick, like back and forth, and I don't believe that it's perfectly natural. I could believe it could be, but there are notes, and there are like his internal like thought process changes so dramatically, so quickly that it doesn't feel like a natural train of thought.
Okay,
I'm reaching, agonizing towards bias right
now. Okay.
Really focusing on it. So maybe I'm
focusing. Sure.
Could be.
Yeah, all good. Just curious. So he's met with this raucous set of cheers, people, you know, praising him in so many words and so many ways. As he has obviously saved the city from this peasant invasion, but he himself feels as though he's done very little in any case. He approaches the royal dais. Hoff nudges the king for his attention, and he falls over. The king is dead.
So, first of all, first things first, going to the first part. He feels as though he's done very little for a minute.
Right.
And then, like, that's sort of where this unnatural train of thought
goes. Okay, so the quote, yeah. I'll just read it for you here, just again, because you've only read it once. With each street Jizal passed down, he relaxed a little more. He slowly began to feel as if he must indeed have achieved something worthy of the honor. To wonder if he might, in fact, have been a dauntless commander, a masterful negotiator. If the people of the city wished to worship him as a hero, he began to suppose it would be churlish to refuse.
So that's kind of part of where that thought process.
Yeah, I will lend a little bit of credence to your argument, and I think that there is there is something about a bunch of people cheering for you that also can be empowering in a way of like, that's I did the point. Fucking right thing. But also there's always the potential of Baez being a meddler because he is. You know.
I feel like if I were in that situation, I'd feel more and more like I didn't earn it the farther I went, but I dissolved.
Yeah, he's got an ego on him.
He does have an ego on him. Yeah, King falls over. King has a stain in his pants. I don't know if it's piss or shit. I want to know.
Probably both.
Probably could be both. I don't actually care. God damn it, this means the people aren't cheering for Jizal anymore, huh?
Rip.
That's a fucking ending to this chapter. Like
his own ego. And that's where I believe personally that it's a little bit more of a like him taking in the cheers versus it being Baez, like inflating his ego. I think
Well,
inadvertently, you could argue that it is Baez inflating his ego.
That's yeah. As far as my limited understanding of Baez's abilities to like fan the flames of emotions and thoughts and things are that he can't incept thoughts into you. He can just kind of pull them out.
Nudge. Yeah.
He can nudge them. So that's kind of what I'm thinking. I don't think these thoughts don't exist within Giselle. I think they're being focused on.
Interesting. Okay. Cool. All right. Well, sweet. Well, that's the week. Did you have any other notes or any other thoughts?
Probably. No, I think we're good.
Cool. Well, PJ, hell of a week. I do want to say you did lose a bet. However, I don't have a beverage as of yet.
You lost a bet or I lost a bet?
You lost a bet this week, which is interesting. PJ is going to have a little bit of his infinity bottle right now. PJ, the bet was the Tanner. The Tanner is a decentralized group, not a singular person. So I want to real quickly, at the very least, repudiate maybe the immediate rebuttal of, you know, well, is the Tanner the Tanner or is the Tanner someone else? But I think that it's inarguable that it's not a group at the very least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know where that thought came from. Like, it was literally like while we were talking about that, like, note, I just like it popped in my brain. I'm like, I'm just going to talk about that right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to make that a bet. I have no idea why.
Sure.
I did that.
You do not have to drink all that because we may as well record the, like, we've been talking, we should probably do at least one dragon episode because we've got, yeah, anyway. Wow. That infinity bottle is really good with that hibiki right on the top. Mm-hmm. it's also just very good. Cool. But that was one that I figured made the most sense to pay off. There are a couple of other ones that are still hanging out here, of course, that we will eventually get to. None of these will pass into the next series.
I like the one that you wrote here that says, Kwai kills his bias.
That's what you said.
With an apostrophe?
Yes.
When did I say that?
Well, maybe it was more like kills. Yeah, it was killses. It was during the killses. Now, I just made it infinitely worse. It was during the wrap up episode.
Ah,
yeah, yeah.
Yep, that makes sense.
Leanna asked you for predictions, and so that was one of them that you wishes rather, wishes. And that was and she went, that's not a fucking wish. but yeah, so. That was one. And then also the Dog Man one. And then she was also like, well, that's not much either. This is just very funny. Cool. I'm very excited to get into the rest of this. Next week, like I'd already mentioned, you're going to be in Alaska. We're going to record this episode probably on Thursday, hopefully for release on Friday. It might be Saturday. This might be like a 1-day delay thing because you get back on Wednesday. So like there's no hope for us. that said, the reading for that week is going to be Too Many Knives Through Prepared for the Worst. Again, not a terribly long reading, you know, because we want to be able to turn around quickly, but, we hope you guys enjoy this little segment. I'm very excited. This is, very close to what I had already arranged for this episode. So
yeah,
it's not too much of an adjustment.
Just for everybody's sort of mind understanding of the schedule. Have you gone through and corrected the?
No, I have not. That will happen this week, though.
Okay.
When you're in Alaska,
we'll get the website updated with the new track.
Yes, yeah, because basically, so originally I'd broken up part one basically into three parts, and now it's going to be four, maybe five, just because of the pacing of different things. I think it's going to be four.
Okay.
So this should be like the penultimate part of part one. Then the week following will be the end of part one, and then kind of resuming the schedule as I had originally planned from there. But really, it's just been breaking up part one into smaller chunks. So,
cool.
Yeah. So again, Too Many Knives Through Prepared for the Worst. With that, that's our week. Thank you guys so much for listening. Of course, check us out, patreon.com/wordsandwhiskey. You can check us out there. Like we've been talking about, and like I mentioned right before this, we've been covering House of the Dragon. We're catching up, finally. Probably do three, maybe four tonight, depending on what we decide to do as a combination, and then do five tomorrow and try to catch up. I don't know. Yep. We'll figure that out. But yeah, regardless, very excited for Dragon Show. Probably Rings of Power next. Is that kind of what we settled? I mean, there's got to be a show in between because Rings of Power doesn't come out immediately. But
yeah, we talked about doing another, like a book.
Maybe. I was thinking a book between series, like a breakup book that way. But we also had discussed maybe doing a book as like a, I don't know, a thing. But or that like feels like a
short story.
I can't remember. Something like that. I'd have to double check.
Like the King short story collection?
Oh, like If It Bleeds or something like that. Yeah. We talked about doing one of those. You're right. I did. Yeah. I think I mentioned maybe doing the collection, what's it called? Four Past Midnight, which is the four short stories that make up some of King's best works, like Shawshank Redemption. That's different seasons. Anyway, there's a couple of different short story novella collections that'd be fun to cover. So
yeah, we'll do something.
Could be fun.
Figure it out and let you guys know soon.
But we're focusing it on something as opposed to, you know, keeping it just ambiguous, chatty.
Yeah.
So
I'm liking that.
Yeah, me too. But also no pressure on the other side of things. So beyond that, you can find us on social media, Words Whiskey Pod, everywhere, Words Whiskey Show in a lot of places. You can email us, wordsandwhiskeyshow@gmail.com. You can call us at phone number
910-408-2534.
I am on Threads more often now. I've been trying to post more there. We, again, are posting more things on Instagram, Reels, and otherwise, including, I appreciate the love that I got from the people of whom knew, you know, anyone who's an early 2000s head. But man, this Strong Bad bit was one of my favorite bits that we've done in the show in a long time. And I'm glad I got to render it out into the into the Strong Bad episode itself. It was great. Love it. Unfortunately, Instagram absolutely buried it because they wanted me to pay to promote it. And I was like, no, I'm not fucking doing that. So anyway, it's fine. With that, make sure you leave us a 5-star review. If you don't leave us a 5-star review, PJ, what are you doing to them this week?
Promoting them twice in their in their army of choice and then trying to install them as
Sounds better than it is. If you're listening,
good.
It sounds pretty good, but that responsibility is a lot.
Yeah, and you're not actually powerful. You're a puppet. I will install you as a puppet king.
Like Kermit with like hand up ass sound puppet?
Maybe.
Reminded of the dropout. I'm reminded of the dropout sketch with the honorary degree. Ryan Kremer, thank you so much. With that, we'll talk to you next week.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.